you may hand it over to my friend, the Treasurer of the United States." And Bierce's coverage and diatribes on the subject aroused such public wrath that the bill was defeated. And so there's a good thing. And Ambrose Bierce also wrote a lot of short stories, some of which were considered quite weird in his day. He was a precursor to Lovecraft and wrote some very interesting things there. All right. Pardon me as I choke in the air here. All right. And that's it for this segment of email, of mail. We love to get mail. If you want to write to us, you can write to me. My name is R. Paul Martin. That's M-A-R-T-I-N, care of WBAI, 388 Atlantic Avenue, third floor, Brooklyn, New York, 11217. That's R. Paul Martin, M-A-R-T-I-N, care of WBAI, 388 Atlantic Avenue, third floor, Brooklyn, New York, 11217. If you want to send me an email, I am rpm@glib.com. That's rpm@glib.com. And we'd love to give you a, if you want to write to us and you don't want it read on the air, say at the top, "I don't want it read on the air," and we will read it on the air. Easy enough, huh? Okay, so there is that. If you want to write to us, there are all those options. Okay, next thing. What are we doing? Oh, next we want to talk a little bit about Coney Island. We go to Coney Island. We live in Brooklyn, so we go to Coney Island rather a bit. And we went down there recently, the other day. And, you know, we've been keeping track of things. We used to go down there for years, and then Superstorm Sandy hit and devastated Coney Island. It just, the water was to a height of 5 feet on Surf Avenue. Nathan's was totally ruined. Everything got wrecked, except for their signs. Their neon signs were like, you know, 20 feet off the ground, so they survived. But their entire electrical, everything that was supposed to work in there, the cash registers, their computers, because everything's computerized these days, everything got wrecked under all that yucky water. And so they spent months and months and months building, rebuilding and everything. And they have rebuilt with the future in mind. They've put their electrical and everything else. The core of it is way up high, higher than any big superstorm surge is supposed to get. Any storm that can get up there now will probably destroy everything anyway, so, you know, don't worry about it. But anyway, we went to Coney Island, and we looked around. The main thing we saw that's new was this enormous pipe. There's a gigantic pipe going along the boardwalk, and we're saying, "Oh, what is this thing?" And so we were looking at that. And, you know, we're trying to figure it out. And we walk along the boardwalk for a while. And then we see this enormous object. It looks at first like a Martian war machine. In fact, if you go up to glib.com, my website, if you go up there, there's a navigation frame on the left-hand side that says latest back-of-the-book program links. And you can click on that, and it will take you to the web page for this program. There's a web page for every program, and this web page so far has only one photograph on it, and that's a photograph of this thing, and it's labeled Martian War Machine. It isn't really. What it is, it's a gigantic tricycle. It's like 20 or 30 feet in the air, and it is really a tricycle. A guy stands on this platform, and he drives it, and, you know, he's 20 or 30 feet in the air, and these big wheels are on it, and he drives it around. And we didn't get to see anybody driving it, but we got to see it. Previously, we've seen people using GPS to map out the entire beach at Coney Island, which got devastated by Superstorm Sandy, and I think Pickles has some information about that. And so we went there, and we looked around, and then we got over by near Stillwell Avenue. We walked along the boardwalk, saw that big tricycle, and then we walked back along the beach. And as we got towards Stillwell Avenue, we saw the pipe, which we had seen earlier, and we saw the extension of it was going down towards the water. And so we went in there, and we looked, and there were these machines, and they looked like they were either valves or pumps, and they were pumping, and there was water squirting out of them. And then there was a pipe that was aimed north. Now, the water is south, and this was aimed north, and it was carving out a lot of sand, and it was squirting, you know, huge amounts of water. This is like a 12-inch in diameter pipe, and it was gushing water. And we're saying, what the hell is all this? And we're watching this stuff, and we were trying to figure out, and two guys came over and said, do you know what this is? And we said, oh, we don't know. And so it was all going on there and pumping away. And we were trying to figure it out. I took photographs. I took a video of the pumping operation. And we noticed after a while that the water stopped gushing. We said, what's this? And there was this enormous pipe that went up the beach and then headed west on the beach. And we tried to walk to the end of the pipe, but we were tired. We couldn't get there. So we said, ah, to hell with it. But as we're walking along the pipe, I can hear stuff. There's stuff in the pipe. And it's not just water. And I'm listening to it, and you can hear it. The stuff is coming from the end of the pipe that's in the water, and it's going west. So they're not pumping anything out of the beach or anything. They're pumping stuff in. And then we figured out it's a dredging operation. And there are no signs or anything except a sign that says, you know, don't go here, it's dangerous. High, you know, under high pressure or something like that. Pardon me as I cough in the air. And so we took photographs. I have some audio of this, and I'm going to play the audio for a little bit. It's less than a minute of audio, so it isn't, you know, it isn't the most terrible thing. Again, this may be something that many people will find dopey or something, or it may just be, well, I don't know what it's going to be. You decide for yourself what you think this is going to be. This is the dredging sound, the sound of the pipe, because it was very mysterious. We went up to it, you know, what is this? We since figured out and looked up online that it is the dredging operation where the Army Corps of Engineers is going to replace the sand that was lost to Superstorm Sandy, where they lost an enormous amount of sand. So here's the sound of dredging being done at Coney Island. It is 16:57 on Thursday, September 26th, 2013, and it is big pipe thing on the beach at Coney Island, and I'm going to get some of the odd sounds coming out of it. These pipes look rather corroded close up. Indeed. And so that's what we were hearing. I mean, at first, you know, you look at the pipe and you start hearing it making those noises, and it's obviously more than just water in there. And so you're saying, geez, what the hell is this? And anyway, so that's what we were hearing. And it was quite something. Now you'll hear, you know, that's the sand, a slurry of salt water and sand going through it. But you're hearing clunk, clunk, bang, and stuff like that. And what that is those are little rocks, pebbles, and probably the occasional sea creature getting sucked up from wherever they're sucking this stuff up from. and it's all being shoved through this enormous pipe. The pipes are like 2 feet in diameter or something, I think. So, you know, it's quite the thing. But yeah, you're probably hearing little pebbles, not so little pebbles sometimes, and shellfish bouncing around. And I think the shellfish become deceased when they bounce that much against a steel pipe, even a rotting and corroded and rusted steel pipe. But so, my dear, you have some information about this, don't you?
Well, firstly, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, they, I guess they award the contract, and they gave it to Great Lakes Dredge and Dock Company for the placement of approximately 600,000 cubic yards of sand along the beach of Coney Island. And this will include approximately 272,000 cubic yards of sand to replace sand lost during Hurricane Sandy, and the remaining amount of sand to restore the project area to its original design profile. And they're dredging all that sand up from Jamaica Bay Inlet Federal Navigation Channel. And apparently this helps to keep the channel safe for shipping as well. And they expect to be able to finish this by the fall. And they're doing it at a time where there aren't as many people at the beach now. Yes, certainly there aren't, aside from the polar bear club people, there aren't that many people swimming. There's the occasional hardy soul out there swimming. But yes, the Sandy, and it's almost a year now since the storm, the great storm hit, did a real number on the beach front and also the housing of a lot of folks who live down on Coney Island who are still suffering. It's pretty just awful, just generally a horrible, awful storm. And of course, the beach at Coney Island, as it were used to it, really only got in its current state, pre-storm, in the 1990s. It was the U.S. Army Corps went in there, and they put a big 850-foot-long terminal groin on the westernmost end of the project at West 37th Street, a retaining wall at 25th Street, which you can see in the sand. And so that beach really, the current beach, before it got blasted away, was the beach from the 90s.
It was about 20 years old.
Yeah.
When it got destroyed.
The boardwalk, I believe, was it 1929? It was, they finished building it, I think.
I think it was earlier than that.
No, actually, no. It is not.
When they started, I think it was earlier than, well,
but it was,
it started earlier, of course.
But it was the 20s, and, yeah. And of course, there was no beach there.
There was no sandy beach
there. Was
there.
No sandy
Coney
beach
Island
there.
Coney Island was just, if you look at Coney Island Creek, which is in back of Coney Island, it's north of Coney Island, you'll see it's just like there's, you know, soil or dirt, and there's water that washes up on it with the tide, and that's what you had there at Coney Island when I think Henry Hudson landed
mm-hmm.
there at some point.
Yes.
And you know, came ashore and said, oh, I want to go in a parachute jump. No, he didn't do that, stop it. And he landed his folks there, and they looked around. They didn't have a sandy beach. They just had soil, which you can see on most normal beaches. Sandy beaches are a special thing.
The big important thing that would really help for the future storms that are going to hit, and we're not talking about the distant future either, we're talking about the near future. Well, here's something. In 1972, the Corps recommended building a 15-foot-high flood wall along Coney Island Peninsula from Manhattan Beach to Seagate. It would have cost $100 million in 1972. And so, of course, they didn't do it because that was a tremendous amount of money and there wasn't a will or a push to do that. And sort of what happened is a result, partly, you know, the horrific storm, because there wasn't any big kind of precautionary measures taken. Because people didn't think this kind of storm would happen, I guess.
Yeah, we're, you know, it's greater New York. We don't get these kinds of things. We don't get floods. We don't get super-duper hurricanes.
We do
now. Well, we do now. Thank you, global warming, which some people actually insist, still insist, doesn't exist, which the Bush administration insisted didn't exist. Oh, boy. Anyway. So we saw all of that, and we're going to put up more photographs on the webpage for this radio program, and we'll be keeping watching it. We have a lot of photographs of Coney Island, and here and there we put some together and put a separate page up about a particular day or a particular topic and various things on the website. Anyway, which is glib.com, glib.com. And no, we're not making money out of it. It's just yet another place where R. Paul shoots his mouth off, which is something I do rather a bit. Now, speaking of things like Superstorm Sandy and, it's a little warmer these days. The latest Scientific American is out, and the latest report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, is now out. And it's the fifth report, and it's described as massive, and it's released in four parts. It's so big. Between now and October 2014, they're releasing the fifth report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And in Scientific American, the editors say it's already out of date. And this is the latest Scientific American. This is the October 2013 Scientific American. And the editors say, there are a number of things you won't find in the new report. For instance, a study published last November found that Arctic permafrost is thawing much faster than we thought. We talked a tiny bit about that on this program. The fact that it's thawing faster, it's a phenomenon called thermokarst, where this ancient plant material, and a little animal material mixed in there sometimes, got frozen long, many thousands of years ago. It got frozen by one of the ice ages. And essentially you have something like, a lot like a peat bog, except it hasn't been rotting all this time. It's like a peat bog that was put in the refrigerator. And what happens with thermokarst is the ice that it's been embedded in melts. And this does several things. It makes more clouds, more water in the atmosphere. And then this proto-peat bog and other kinds of things, but peat bog is what a lot of it turns into. It sort of becomes the peat bog in a real, real fast hurry, because even though it's been frozen, you've still got some microbes in there, plus other microbes very rapidly find things like this, and they start eating. And once they start eating and reproducing, microbial flatulence ensues. And in Scientific American is saying this could expel massive quantities of the greenhouse gas methane into the atmosphere, accelerating climate change. And already there are like villages up in Siberia and in Alaska where people have had to abandon places they've been living for hundreds of years because in some cases in Alaska, the islands are disappearing that they were living on. In some places that weren't islands are islands now and are disappearing. In other places, the ground won't support anything because it's not quicksand. It's quick plant material that's a few thousand years old and, is just giving up completely and turning into a rapid peat bog. And so you get this boggy stuff that it's not even a swamp. A swamp is more alive than a bog. And so if you sink in that, you could drown in it. You can't build any structures on it. You can't really move through it. It's like you're wading through seaweed that's very, very, very dense. You know, I mean, imagine trying to wade through tree branches. It's not too different from that. In some cases, it is that because there are tree branches from trees that died thousands of years ago in there. All sorts of things. And it's the land of thermokarst is not useful for human beings. Anyway, the editors of Scientific American also note something else that's not in this report that just came out. Ice sheets in Greenland and the Antarctic are also melting faster than anticipated, which could make the IPCC's estimate for sea level rise read like yesterday's newspaper. We talked on the air about the phenomenon of this. What's happened is the ice sheets are not just warming on top, but they're warming from below. Because some of them, especially the ones that stick out over the water, they're getting warmed by the water from below. So they're at least 20%. There's more 20% more melting going on than people had realized previously, and that's very significant. And Greenland and Antarctica are putting out a great deal of water, raising the sea level. You know, when something the size of the state of Delaware breaks off from Antarctica, that's very serious. Now, some of that ice was floating, but not entirely. And, you know, that also means that the ice that wasn't floating is now the front of the glacier. And it's the face of the glacier is what's going to melt and go in there. So more, you know, water going in. And Greenland is just like a gigantic fire hydrant that, you know, some titan has turned on. Anyway, they're continuing here in Scientific American saying, in July, Kerry Emanuel of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology updated the computer models used by the IPCC with more fine-grained data about cyclones, revealing that these storms could increase in number, not just in intensity, which is what the current report says. Current report says they're going to increase in intensity, which we talked about here years ago on this program. And so there's going to be more of them, too. Not good news. And they fault the laborious review process of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And they say the process also forces the IPCC to stop considering new results a year or even 2 years before the assessment comes out, and it may not fully integrate research that is older than that. So these are, you know, there are people trying to deny these reports about climate change. However, the reports coming out with all that good faith but a lot of bureaucracy, they're not telling the tale as bad as it is. They're sort of, you know, glossing over what's really happening. What's really happening is worse. Oh, my. Anyway, some of you are asking, who the hell are these people? We'll give you a fast and final identification of who these people are that you're hearing right now.
This is WBAI New York 99.5 FM, broadcasting from a hilltop in Harlem and streaming live at WBAI.org. The program is back of the book. He is our Paul Martin, and she is Radio Spiegels of the North. You can find out more by going to his website at glib.com. You can also look at WBAI.org, the official website of this radio station. There is also WBAI.net, a listener group's website, and then there is the Bleep and Blue Board at listenerforums.net, where listenerforums is one word.
A single word. All right, thank you, Henrietta Hexadecimal 1.1. And for those of you tuning in and saying, where's Simon Lokley? I need my weekly shot of James Joyce. Simon isn't here. Simon is on vacation. I think he announced this here last week. Simon is on vacation, and he's in Eastern Europe right now and visiting friends. So that's what's going on with Simon right there. Simon will be back. Simon will be back here in 4 weeks. He's going away for 3 weeks, so for the next 3 weeks, Simon will not be here. And Simon, of course, is getting this time slot, this two-hour time slot that has been he's been doing here for only a few weeks now, and he'll be doing that. So if you're missing Simon, we all are, but hey, he'll be back. Don't worry, he'll be back. All right. We want to discuss something else here, and we're going to very rapidly get in the mood with a little bit of music here. So, let's get ready. We played Golden Slumbers by the Beatles here. We are not licensed to post any music to our websites, so I've had to edit that out of this archive. Whoa, that was a little short. Well, there goes that CD. Anyway, yes, we're going to talk a little bit right here about sleep. Now, we generally do a radio program that is aired in the wee hours. We used to do it in the much weirder hours than we do it these days. But, well, now we're at 5 o'clock most of the time. And one of the things that, you know, we used to do a program that went from 1 to 3 o'clock in the morning. And one of the things that you learn when you're doing all of this stuff is that, well, there are some things you probably don't want to mention on the air. No, not those kinds of things. If you're doing a program, a radio program, and you want to keep listeners listening, and you're doing it in the wee hours, do not start mentioning sleep. Now, most of you who are listening right now are early risers. You folks, probably, at least the vast majority of you listening, probably get up early on a Saturday morning and you listen to the radio. I have to tell you, I am not of your ilk. I'm somebody who generally does not listen to radio on a Saturday morning. In fact, I do my best to be unconscious on most Saturday mornings. So we were a little bit odd here. But this program here, where we're filling in for Simon Locley at his behest, we're on at a time when most of you are, in fact, quite awake and you're not falling back to sleep again. And so the deal is I get to finally talk about something that relates to sleep. And so we're going to talk a little bit here about this. And of course, sleep is something that seems simple, but as with most human things, which involve the human brain, it's extremely complex. One of the things that we talk about here on occasion on Back of the Book, that's the name of this radio program, Back of the Book, is the central myth of our civilization. And that central myth of our civilization is the myth of the integrated personality. We are not single things. We are fragmented. We are reinvented many times per second because we are really patterns, a set of patterns, mostly from our brain, but other parts contribute to it as well. And these patterns are generated and synchronized with other patterns. And you exist from a bunch of patterns that are 40 to 60 times a second reorganized, and you don't exist second to second. You exist jiffy to jiffy, to use a term relating to 1/60th of a second, but it's variously 1/40th or 1/60th. It's in there. Anyway, sleep relates to the brain as well. And sleep is not a single monadic thing. It's a whole bunch of stuff going on. And there are all sorts of issues related to it. And they've only been studied in the past half century or so because people thought they knew what sleep was. And then they started studying it more and getting medical and scientific instruments that could do other things. Well, these days, there is a theory called local sleep theory. And basically it says parts of the brain can be asleep while other parts are awake. And in other words, all of you doesn't sleep all at once. And we have all experienced this. I'm pretty sure everybody has experienced this. I know I have. And you can get a sleep disorder called a non-REM parasomnia. Now, REM is, of course, rapid eye movement. That's when you're dreaming. This is called non-REM parasomnia, and it happens to everybody. One of the things that happens, a manifestation of this, is sleepwalking. People can walk around. Now, you know, if you're watching The Honeymooners, it's the classic cartoon thing of, you know, Norton is there and he's got his hat on and he's got his hands out in front of him and his eyes are closed and he's walking around. Well, it doesn't quite work that way, although it can work that way, I suppose, but it doesn't quite work that way. And I'm looking at an article in Scientific American from last year, and in the article here, the article by James Vlahos, they're talking about people using sleepwalking as a defense in murder cases. And it says here, the first time in American legal history that sleepwalking was successfully used as a defense against murder was in the 1846 trial of Albert Jackson Terrell, who killed a prostitute by nearly beheading her with a razor. More recently, in Toronto in 1987, a 23-year-old man named Kenneth Parks drove 14 miles and murdered his mother-in-law, allegedly all while sleepwalking unaware. He was subsequently acquitted. And there are about 40 million Americans who suffer from some kind of sleep disorder. And again, these are all called parasomnias. And we all have disorders. And through studying the disorders, they have discovered how the brain works and how the brain, in fact, doesn't all sleep at once. In fact, if your brain slept all at once, if everything shut down in your brain, you would die because you wouldn't be able to breathe or your heart wouldn't beat. And Dr. James Kruger, who is currently at Washington State University in Spokane, has been doing various experiments on this. And he's been looking at evidence for partial brain sleep in other animals. For instance, dolphins, they sleep with half their brain at a time, and they swim with one eye open when they're asleep, which I hadn't known, but that's an interesting factoidal thing. And Kruger finds that individual parts of the brain, neural networks, and perhaps even individual neurons, go to sleep at different times around the clock depending on how much they have been used recently. This is why researchers describe sleep as both local, affecting only distinct parts of the brain at different times, and use-dependent, occurring only after the region has been sufficiently taxed. And only when most of the brain's neurons are in a sleep condition does sleep's characteristic behavior kick in, things like stillness, closed eyes, slackened muscles. Long before that, however, tiny chunks of the brain are going to sleep. And David Rector, a colleague of Kruger's at Washington State University, Pullman, has been doing rat studies. And Rector established what the electrical response to whisker twitching in rats does, what it looks like when the whole animal was behaviorally awake and it was when it was behaviorally asleep. He twitched the rat's whiskers at various times. Then he uncovered exciting exceptions to the rule, findings that columns can exist, the columns in the brain, can exist in a sleep-like state during whole animal wake episodes, and, conversely, that columns can exist in awake-like states during whole animal sleep, which suggests that sleep is a property of individual cortical columns. And Huss van Dongen, another scientist in Spokane, had subjects look at a computer screen and press a button as soon as a reaction time counter pops up. And these subjects are directed to perform this action repeatedly for 10 minutes, and their response times slow as the task progresses. And these are called vigilance tests, and they are used to repeatedly tax the same neural pathways, and extensive use during the experiment forces them into a sleep state. And Dr. Vindangens says he sees this as evidence of local sleep rather than more globalized fatigue or boredom, because the performance of his subjects improves immediately when they're allowed to switch to a different task that calls on different parts of the brain. This is why, like, insomniacs can say, I didn't sleep a wink, but you do a brain scan of them, you know, while they're asleep, and it shows they were largely asleep. Well, that's because some part of them was awake, and that part was, you know, sort of conscious. And anyway, so you have a condition called sleep dissociation, where the physical and mental attributes of alertness, deep sleep, and dreaming overlap. And afflicted people can have significant parts of their brain offline, even when their body is awake and doing stuff. And so you have these things happening, and brain imaging studies suggest that during NREM, non-REM sleep, the prefrontal cortex, which is the part of the brain located just behind your forehead, and that's where reason and moral judgments are performed. In other words, your amygdala is impulsive, and it makes you say, "Ah, what you did that? I'm going to kill you," you know, and do something. But before you react to that, you get impulse control, which comes out of your prefrontal cortex, which basically says, "Oh, wait a minute, stop! All right, don't do this. Calm down," and stops you from doing things that would probably get you arrested. And the prefrontal cortex is much less active when it's in a sleep state than when an individual is awake. The midbrain, however, where the amygdala and other things are, it's active and it's capable of generating simple behaviors called fixed action patterns. And these are things like standing, walking, predatory attack, drinking, eating, grooming, and sexual and maternal behaviors. And the prefrontal cortex normally checks a lot of these patterns when they're inappropriate, but during NREM sleep, this part of the brain isn't working. So people become more like wild animals governed by instincts doing things. So there are two things to consider here. One, you ever get up and you, oh, I'm not quite awake yet. Well, that's true. That means parts of your brain aren't awake yet and you're feeling groggy. And yeah, you're not exactly awake. So that's what's happening then, is parts of your brain haven't caught up. If you're lucky, various other parts, you know, the parts that are asleep will catch up with the parts that are awake. And then on the other side of it, when you're trying to go to sleep, some of you starts getting there and other parts of you are awake. This is how you can end up sleepwalking or something like that. And you know, sometimes doing lesser things, like if you read, you will sometimes find you've put a bookmark in and you say, I don't remember reading that at all. But you were going through the motions of reading it, but parts of you were asleep and you don't remember what you read. And so this is a very interesting thing. And of course, the other interesting thing is that you can fatigue parts of the brain and they essentially go to sleep. This is probably what hypnotism does. You know, when you dangle the watch or shiny thing in front of somebody, you're getting some, now pay close attention to this. Watch this as I dangle it in front of you. And what you can do is put part of somebody's brain asleep by dangling it, by basically taxing them. And they're really concentrating on this shiny thing. And after a while, that part of the brain gets tired and is essentially going offline, going asleep. And so there are all sorts of things that these relate to in our lives, especially the part about where, even in the middle of the day, it doesn't have to be when you're getting up, but in the middle of the day, you can feel like, geez, I'm not all here. I'm not firing on all cylinders. What is this? Sometimes a part of you has gone to sleep. And it can be very inconvenient. I've had this kind of thing happen where you're saying, oh, geez, you know, I'm trying to do this and, you know, some computer stuff. And maybe you've been doing a lot of that same stuff. And after a while, you get, you know, oh, man, this is tough to do. And you can even have other parts if you're starting to feel sort of almost sleepy. Oh, can't look like I'm falling asleep here. They'll think I'm slacking off in a job. But that's what's happening. You can induce sleep to parts of your brain. This is why it's a good idea when you're doing something intensive like computer stuff or many other things, take a break. Take a break, get up, walk around. If you're doing a radio program where you have to talk for 3 solid hours, you play something and you get up and you go out and you have some water and you come back in and, you know, you do stuff like that. So that is some interesting insight from, you know, some deep science on things that happen to every one of us and things that happen pretty much every day. I know that most of the time when I get up, it takes a while for me to fully get awake, if I even do get fully awake. I remember there was I was trying to help my sleep. My sleep and wake is a mess. And I was trying to help my sleeping habits. And so melatonin was the big thing. And I took it, didn't do anything. Took two of them, didn't do anything. Took 3, which they said it's the maximum dose. Did nothing. So the hell with it. I took 4. 4 did sort of put me to sleep. And the next day, I was miserable because I could feel that a part of me was still asleep. It couldn't wake up. And I also recognized that there are times when without taking melatonin, I felt the same way. And I said, that's it. Some of the sleep chemicals are still abroad in the brain. I think there are 4 sleep hormones that you need to really go to sleep. And if you don't have them all, you're not getting fully asleep. And it's probably because parts of your brain are still awake. And then your brain might put out too many sleep hormones or one sleep hormone a lot. And you're awake and you're moving around, but you're saying, God, it feels like I'm moving through molasses and I'm trying to think of things that I'm forgetting and I'm not sharp. And it's because of that, probably a combination of sleep hormones and other things happening that make pieces, maybe one part, maybe more than one part of your brain, asleep, basically, when the rest of you is walking around and saying, oh, yes, I can do that. Maybe you can't. So there we are. This is how our brain works. This is a thing that happens to human beings. And a little bit of insight there. And maybe we can all do better and, you know, not torture ourselves and realize that, yeah, after 30 minutes, taking a break is not being lazy. It's kind of the opposite. It will wake you up. Yeah. So most of you are awake. And me, well, I've been awake since yesterday. So what sort of a state am I in? We played I'm Only Sleeping by the Beatles at the conclusion of the piece on sleeping and the brain. We are not licensed to post any music to our websites, so I've had to edit that out of this archive. And there's rather a description of what we were just talking about. And we're coming up to the very, very end of everything here. And we're going to be splitting out of here within mere mementos. And I wanted to say fast, you know, there's this guy, Guido Barilla, who makes the world's famous pasta. And he went on TV and said his advertising would only feature, quote, classic families. And on a radio program, he said, quote, I would never do a commercial with a homosexual family, not for lack of respect, but because we don't agree with them. Ours is a classic family where the woman plays a fundamental role, unquote. And he said, if gay people, quote, like our pasta and our advertising, they'll eat our pasta. If they don't like it, then they will not eat them and they will eat another brand, unquote. So, oh boy, what a crumb. He issued a clarification and posted to the website. He said, quote, I apologize if my words have generated controversy or misunderstanding or if they hurt someone's sensitivity. For clarity, I would like to point out that I have the utmost respect for gay people and for everyone's right to express themselves. I've also said I would like to reiterate that I respect gay marriages. Well, you know, Jesus Christ, Jack, you have a funny way of showing that sort of thing. Oh, my. Well, we got to get out of here, folks. It's been quite a bit of a while here. And thanks a hell of a lot for listening to us. And thank you, all of you who are Simon Locally listeners who tuned in. We hope some of you stayed with us. And we will be back in 2 weeks at 5 o'clock in the morning. And we'll be doing all sorts of things. We played our outro here, Baker Street by Jerry Rafferty. We are not licensed to post any music to our websites, so I've had to edit this part of the archive. For the rest of this program, we just said that the thon starts on Tuesday, and it's vitally important that folks support the radio station. If we don't raise money, we are screwed. I promoted the next program and recommended that people tune in next week at 5 a.m. for Uncle Sidney Smith's program, Saturday Morning with the Radio On, when he'll be doing a 3-hour program. And I told everyone to remember what that hardly half awake, but enjoying autumn anyway, Dormouse said.